After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, visit www.beherenownetwork.com/Sharon. Enjoy listening.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm joined by Rich Fernandez for today's episode of the Metta Hour podcast. Rich is the CEO of the Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute, a nonprofit organization developed at Google that now offers Google's mindfulness and emotional intelligence curriculum to communities and organizations around the world. Rich also co-founded Wisdom Labs, an organization that brings the science of mindfulness, resilience, and thriving into organizations. Rich also has a decade of experience working as a learning and leadership development executive in the financial services sector at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and at Bank of America. Rich was trained as a psychologist and received his Ph.D. from Columbia University, and he's an author and frequent contributor to Harvard Business Review. He's a neuroscience enthusiast and a longtime trained and certified mindfulness practitioner and teacher. So welcome, Rich.
Hi, Sharon. It's great to be here.
It's great to talk to you. I usually like to start these conversations with just hearing some of the background of your story and what first brought you to the path of mindfulness and meditation. I think when we first met, you were still at Google, and you hadn't yet formed Wisdom Labs.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I was the head of executive education at Google, looking after leadership development for the senior leaders at Google globally. And, you know, it was interesting because I was actually on a meditation retreat with our friend John Kabat-Zinn and Will Kabat-Zinn, and just really had the sense that this was it, right? That the ground of mindfulness was where I wanted to spend all of my time really working. And that signaled for me a shift where at that point, this was about 6 years ago, I decided to leave Google and start Wisdom Labs and now eventually come to Silly to really offer the tools of mindfulness to communities, organizations, businesses around the world. You know, though, to answer your question, it's interesting. For me, mindfulness has been a part of my life from very early on. So I would trace, people have sometimes asked, you know, when is the first time you really exercised mindfulness or meditated? And I actually can remember when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I went to a Catholic school. And I remember, and I grew up in Manhattan in New York City, and so I could just walk to school. And I remember I liked to go to school about 15 or 20 minutes early to stop into the church because no one was there and it was really quiet and really still. And I remember just enjoying sitting there, you know, right around the middle school years, kind of a chaotic time. I remember just enjoying how quiet and still it was. And so I would often make a point to just go early. Of course, I had to convince my mom that I was actually going to church.
You know, sure, you're going to church.
No service. Yeah, are you really? What? Are you really? There is no service happening. I said, well, exactly, Mom. It's, you know, it's quiet, and I just like to do that before class. So, you know, I would only do that a couple of times a week and not every week, of course. I was a kid, but I do remember that as a really important sort of moment where I learned kind of the power of the pause, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then carrying forward, I learned formal meditation in college. When I was introduced to meditation and how you can sort of actively cultivate it through this quite rigorous process, actually, I really appreciated the structure that provided, and so that really began my journey that I've pretty much been on ever since.
And I'm really curious, like when you sat with John and Will, what moved you to sort of particularly bring the process and the tools into business? Had you seen just a lot of suffering within business or stress or what was it?
Yeah, well, you know, so the story really goes even further back than that, because as I mentioned, I had been a mindfulness and meditation practitioner pretty much all of my adult life. And then I went into the field of psychology, and after getting my graduate degree, I went into industry and worked in financial services. Then I went over to eBay, where I was the head of learning and organization development. And this was right around the time of the financial crisis. So this is 2007, 2008. And I saw a lot of people suffering to the point. And I realized that what I had been doing privately as my own mindfulness practice was so beneficial to me as sort of a foundation to navigate, you know, challenging times and circumstances in life, that the employees in some ways might be able to benefit from similar practices. So this was back then, and I started to introduce mindfulness in workshops. I invited speakers, and the courses were wildly popular. The workshops were wildly popular. We had at times hundreds of employees coming. I remember George Mumford, our friend George Mumford, you know, I invited him to come. And of course, you know, you really use the word mindfulness as openly as you can now, because it was still a kind of weird back in 2007 to bring that to business. But so we just used, you know, the cultivating a mindset of excellence, with mindfulness as the foundation. So George came, and there were over 400 employees that showed up for this thing. So much so that I got in trouble. You know, I got kind of called into my boss's office and then asked, you know, what are you doing with this mindfulness stuff? Are you trying to keep people awake in meetings? And, you know, but my answer was, yes, it's about waking up, but maybe not in the same way we're thinking, you're thinking.
I think that's a great ad, though. Stay awake in meetings.
Stay awake in meetings. Yeah, well, you know, to that point, Sharon, I had to very much make it relevant to the organization. So I did take the liberty of bringing, sending pre-surveys and post-surveys to all participants in these things. And what we found is that, in fact, they really did benefit. Mm-hmm. At least they self-reported that they found a lot of usefulness and meaning and inspiration in the tools that were being offered. And they were really grateful that the company was offering them. Mm-hmm. And that was important, because that started to get to an important business metric called employee engagement. Mm-hmm. People felt like they were being invested in. They felt like they could invest in turn their own kind of energies and commitment to the organization. And so it appeared that the mindfulness workshops were starting to be beneficial. And I was allowed to continue the experiment grudgingly, you know, to help people wake up. but what happened then, Sharon, was then I went over to Google. Like I said, I had this role of running executive education, and there I was joyfully invited to share an office with Meng,
interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. This is an early Google engineer, for those of you who don't know, who essentially with a number of world experts put together a curriculum called Search, as in Google Search, but inside yourself. And it's really about using mindfulness and compassion as a foundation for emotional intelligence. And it was a way to help Google employees and engineers and, you know, analytically minded people just really connect in through mindfulness into these sort of social and emotional skill building qualities. So anyway, I joined Google, and I moved into this office with Meng. We became great friends, and I joined him in teaching this curriculum and then bringing my own mindfulness practice there as well. And then, you know, some years later, we were on this retreat, like coming back to that retreat with John and Will. And so I had been doing that work for a while, which is bringing mindfulness into organizations into the workplace. Mm-hmm. And at this retreat, you know, I had the experience, as often happens, of, you know, tremendous kind of peace and space, spaciousness, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of settling of the mind, the kind of quieting, and at the same time, the kind of opening that can happen, so that just a great sense of, it's hard to qualify this, you know, but just a sense of joy, spontaneous joy and well-being. And I knew this was the fruit of the mindfulness practice, again, because I, you know, for many years been practicing it and could experience that, but specifically on retreat, it's much more readily accessible. And as I was enjoying that, I remember I was doing walking meditation on a deck in the overlooking the Redwoods. The sun was just coming up. And I just started to have this feeling of spontaneous joy and well-being, and I was very much just, you know, kind of immersed in that. And then, as sometimes happens, a thought came. And so I went with it. You know, the minute I went with it, of course, there was a little less joy and well-being because I kind of got kind of swept with this thought. But the thought was that this experience of wellness, of spontaneous joy, in many ways is the default state, mm-hmm. Is our natural state. And, you know, all of the qualities of mind, the aggregates, the ideas and thoughts and circumstances we move through every day kind of conspire to help us forget that. And so we fall asleep to this idea, this experience of you know, wellness at the deepest level. And so I just started to realize that that's really interesting that we sort of move off this mark. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that in the world of work and specifically in the world of business, it very much is the case that we're pulled away from that, that we forget that. And I knew because I had almost two decades of experience working in Fortune 500 companies at that stage. I think I was about 17 years into, you know, kind of a corporate career. And I realized this is so hard to access mm-hmm. on a regular basis. And I think that's why we're seeing so much interest. So I'm musing about all of this. And of course, I'm a little bit out of that kind of state of, like I said, just kind of full present, mm-hmm. but I'm allowing myself these thoughts because they're real insights, which also is something that mm-hmm. can often arise in the practice. And I realized, you know, we probably spend about 40% of our working life at work, and there's so much suffering.
Yeah.
And if we could but bring these tools into that setting, perhaps we can bring some of this experience of spontaneous joy and deep abiding wellness into the workplace in a really profound way. And at that moment, I also had a really, really powerful sense that that was then going to be the rest of my life's work.
Wow.
And that's kind of where it happened, how it happened.
Wow. It kind of reminds me actually of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who tells the story at sitting at the Insight Meditation Society, the center I co-founded. He was just doing a retreat, and he had the thought, you know what? You could take all of this outside of the kind of Buddhist languaging and talk about it in terms of stress and science, and you can call it mindfulness-based stress reduction. And first you bring it to healthcare, then you bring it to education. And he said, like, this 20-year plan rose up in his mind. So he got up and he wrote it down, and then he did it, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Well, and Jon is, you know, one of my foremost teachers, as are you. It's been a great inspiration to just learn about how these tools are really a fundamental human inheritance,
mm-hmm.
And that they can be really connected in to through any kind of arena, whether, like you said, it's education or healthcare, or, you know, in the case where I have the most experience mm-hmm. in organizations, mm-hmm. business settings, it's really possible, it's accessible, and I think there can be some real measurable, I know there can be some real measurable impact. We've seen that.
Mm. I want to talk to you about that in a minute, but first to step back. Yeah. Into the value of well-being, because,
mm-hmm.
You know, it perhaps should not be a controversial topic, and yet it is. You know, like, I wrote one book which was called Real Happiness, and that was not, it was not the intended title. It just something happened, so at the last minute we needed a title, and the publisher chose Real Happiness. And
oh, I love that.
And I thought, oh, okay, you know, like, on the one hand, I thought that's great. That's what we all really want. You know, we want some sense, each of us, we want a sense of happiness. We want a sense of belonging in our bodies and our minds with one another on this planet. We want some sense of having a home somewhere. And we want that. And we get so confused about where happiness is to be found. And we hear so many kind of crazy messages and we believe them. And, you know, on the other hand, I thought, I'm going to get into trouble for this. And I did. You know, I went on tour with the book. And people would say, oh, because in our many people's minds, happiness is something superficial. It's selfish. It's, you know, removed from your actions. Maybe like I can do anything. Doesn't matter. I'm going to sit at home and be satisfied with myself, you know. And you know, I was touring with a book from town to town. And people would say things to me like, didn't you ever see the bumper sticker that says, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention? And I'd say, well, yeah, I did see it and I understand it. But, you know, what about when we are depressed and we feel overcome and we're exhausted and we're burnt out? Not only are we not serving ourselves, we're not serving anyone else. We just don't have it in us to care about someone, to try to make this world a better place, to even listen to somebody. So happiness, I saw as a sense of resource inside, you know, and wherewithal. You know, then my next book was actually called Real Happiness at Work, which was even worse, you know. People would say to me, we're not supposed to be happy at work. It's why we call it work. If you're supposed to be happy, we'd call it play. And somebody said, you know, you're saying we're supposed to have fun all day long at work. And I said, well, I don't define happiness or real happiness as having fun all day long. You know, but I mean, these are real people, you know, who are working. And as you said, spending an enormous amount of our day, day after day, often at work, outside the home. And yet, you know, if we aren't given some tools for a better sense of community and how to find meaning and how to bring our own values into that workplace, we're sunk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As if you can sort of like check those at the door when you walk into the workplace, right? I think that's the assumption when you hear those kind of narratives about the fact that work isn't the place for those things. Well, who's showing up to work, right? The whole person is showing up to work. If they don't check their values, they don't check their sense of purpose and meaning and well-being at the door when they log in, you know? So I think it's really important to consider that happiness, and I like the way you're describing it, Sharon, which is really a sense of wellness, a sense of resilience and thriving, as opposed to kind of like a pure, you know, unalloyed positivity, which I do have problems with, right? First of all, I think that's a uniquely American construct.
Because
of our audience members that are from, you know, not from the United States, I think, you know, you may relate to this, but I just think it's something in the U.S., the American culture that is about kind of, oh, it always has to be positive. Well, no, it doesn't. And life isn't. But life does have, and work does have, qualities in which that we can experience, where we can experience wellness, where we can experience wholeness, where we can experience the expression of our values. And I think that is really where we can, that's when, like you're saying, that's when we can experience happiness, when we are in fact fully inhabiting those aspects of ourselves, bringing our whole selves to it, and having avenues to be able to access that. And that's where I think the practice comes in. That's where I think mindfulness comes in, so that we can see clearly, we can distinguish, you know, when we're off our mark, when we're misaligned, and then also see solutions, you know, think about our aspirations, think about our strengths and how we can best apply those, how we can best be of benefit and service as well. And so I think that's the role of mindfulness, is activating all of those qualities. And it's a practice, so it's something that can be exercised even when the going gets really difficult, when we feel really misaligned and unhappy at work. There's always the opportunity to bring in the practice and, you know, true up, as I like to say.
What does true up mean?
Oh, true up means to just realign, to kind of like, you know, connect to, you know, your core values, your sense of meaning and purpose, and ensure that you're kind of there, as opposed to, you know, some place that is really far removed from, you know, your sense of wholeness.
I'm wondering if you hear the criticism. You've been in this world and so much a leader in this world for so long. I don't know if you hear the criticism that someone like me would tend to hear, like, bringing mindfulness to corporate America, and this may be a particularly American issue as well, is just giving people tools to stay sort of sleepy, you know, as they're being abused or exploited, and the kind of ethical vacuum that often works in business, or people's projection of that at any rate, and and that these are just tools for kind of contentment rather than looking at a whole picture of how things might change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a fair criticism, actually. I think it's a very constructive criticism because it's important to ensure that mindfulness, as I like to say, that mindfulness does not become mercenary. That it isn't kind of deployed, quote unquote, for the sake of only greater profits and only to kind of drive and squeeze more productivity and then forget people. So in my understanding, from my perspective, you know, mindfulness is really about planting seeds of awareness, planting, helping people as well as organizations and the cultures there really become aware and become conscious of their work practices, you know, and then the outcomes of the things, of their work as well. So it really does go, it does get down to what are the core values, what is the core purpose of work, what are the outputs and the outcomes of working on these things. And it really comes down to that sense of awareness. And ultimately, from the awareness also comes a sense of empathy and compassion, first for oneself, for the folks in the organization, but also the outputs of the organization to the world. Now, I think another fair criticism of that is highly aspirational, that people within companies, teams within companies, the organization itself becomes more aware and more conscious. But from my perspective, it's a worthy aspiration to have, because the alternative is deep unconsciousness. The alternative is potentially, in that unconsciousness, destructiveness. And we've seen that for a long time. And so now I think we're starting to see that when we can bring in awareness and mindfulness and compassion practices into companies, it can actually inform the culture, the outputs, and the work practices. And we have many examples of that, right? Companies now that are starting to become a little bit more focused, some companies, not all, but a little bit more focused on the ways they can be of benefit. There's a few different examples of this as well, you know. So one client we worked with for a long time was Salesforce, and they very much brought in mindfulness and compassion practices right into their core culture. They built meditation rooms on every floor. You know, we programmed guided meditations in each of those rooms that were accessible via an iPad in the corner, and they can just play in the speakers. At their largest customer conference, they would bring in, you know, very prominent teachers like Jack Kornfield, our friend Tara Brach, and, you know, one year we worked with them to bring in the monks and nuns of Plum Village to teach about compassion. And then you start to see it in their business practice. So they have the 1-1-1 model, where 1% of their profits, 1% of their employee time, and 1% of equity are all put into philanthropy, so that the better the company does, you know, the kind of more good they do. Now, again, you can still argue that, you know, well, that, you know, that's a kind of a cynical approach because it's really about the company profiting. But again, I would submit that it's far better than the alternative, first of all. And second of all, this may be aspirational, but I believe that when you start to plant a seed of awareness, and I learned this from one of my other teachers, Thich Nhat Hanh, that seeds of awareness blossom, right, of their own accord once they're planted. They require nurturing and practice, but they start to blossom because the alternative is to not plant seeds of awareness and to allow, you know, business and organizations to just kind of be profligate and to just do whatever they can. The growth is the only and primary driver of business success. I think there's many other aspects that contribute to a successful business that can also grow, that can also enjoy great success. So I can tell you at Google, for example, our core philosophy around people or core aspiration was described as building the happiest, healthiest, and most productive workforce on the planet. Mm. And the idea is you can't get to number three if you don't take care of one and two, happy and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's important for businesses to be productive, but if productivity is the only thing and growth is the only thing, then it really becomes toxic. Because one of the only things that grows unabated and unchecked in nature is cancer.
Mm.
Right? And so that's the danger. And I think in part, it's not a panacea. It's not going to be a silver bullet that's going to solve everything. But I think in part, bringing in mindfulness and compassion practices into the workplace start to shift the lens, the mindset, the perspective of businesses themselves and business cultures. At least that's the hope, and that's a perspective that informs the work that I and my team and my colleagues, we all engage in.
It's a beautiful aspiration. I mean, my own experience is not usually been on that level because I haven't had like a whole program always. Sometimes I have, going into an organization, but that leaves the people, and my response is like, people are people. I've never had an employee anywhere in a whole variety of organizations say to me, I want to use these tools to be like a more soulless, productive, richer, get ahead of everybody else. Every single person says something like they talk about their child, their teenager they're worried about, or their mother who's getting older, or their alcoholic cousin, or just the stress. They're not sleeping, or, they want to have a better family life or something. People are people. And I don't see any reason to withhold these tools.
Yeah,
from people because exactly. They work in a certain place.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great way to describe it. Exactly. And by the way, they are good for business too. So we don't want to lose that fact. In fact, it's a strength to build on. So if you see rises in employee wellness, you also see rises in things like, operating profits of businesses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's also true. Right. And I think that, again, fairly is where the criticism comes in. Oh, you're just helping the businesses be more
mm-hmm.
profitable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they do get more profitable, but people are also getting better.
Right.
So are the two necessarily binary? Do they have to be split off?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a core question that goes to values of the business itself. So if people are getting feel better because of these things and, they're helping the business succeed, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, I think one of the great things about the SILI program, as it's known, Search Inside Yourself Leadership Initiative,
Institute, yeah.
is that it's pretty holistic. You're talking about communication skills. You're talking about emotional intelligence skills. So it's not just a kind of sort of feel good, reductionistic, do this exercise and you'll get through the day better,
Right. Absolutely.
You learn skills that really help you talking to a colleague, talking to a supervisor, whatever it might be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think for us, what we see is that the mindfulness, empathy, and compassion skills, that then the outcome of which is emotional intelligence,
mm-hmm.
They're both intrapersonal, which is within the self. So they do start as a foundation with a foundation of reflection. Some meditation, some related mental exercises of that sort. But then they extend to the interpersonal, and they really go to then how people are able to engage, to listen to one another, because listening is itself is a skill,
mm-hmm.
Mindful listening, how they're able to respond versus react to others, which is what we like to call response flexibility, and then how they also engage in difficult or challenging conversations, which happen all the time in the workplace,
mm-hmm.
Because by definition of people's roles, they will often have conflicting agendas.
Right.
And so how do they negotiate and navigate those? Well, that's, again, where the tools of empathy and compassion, mindfulness, they all have a part to play. So in our SIY program, we absolutely teach people the kind of self-reflection tools, the contemplation self-awareness tools, but we also teach them the empathy and compassion, the listening and conversation tools that are all based on mindfulness, empathy, and compassion that really help them navigate kind of social the social and emotional landscape, which is really present in business, which we don't often also talk about, right? Because it's like, oh, yeah, I leave your emotions at the door. Well, that doesn't happen. People do have emotions at work, at least one a day.
Right, right.
So, you know, I mean, you gotta just deal with it as it is, right? People are whole people at work. And these tools were really developed, like I said earlier, at Google, because the feeling was our analytically minded folks there, you know, could use them, right? Also that emotional intelligence, mindfulness, and compassion are actually skills.
Mm-hmm.
And like any skills, you can develop them with practice. And then it becomes a question of, well, what are the practices? And then that's what we teach. We teach these skills as useful mental habits and that can be learned and that can be developed.
Do you find any kind of resistance to using the word compassion? Like I asked George Mumford, for example, who's been working with sports teams for these many years. You know, I said to him, mm-hmm. Do you use the word mindfulness? And he said, now I can, you know, because of the research and the kind of validity, you know, that's happened because of the research. And I said, do you use the word compassion? He said, that's too much. But mm-hmm. I knew he must talk about the skill. And so I said, what do you say? And he mm-hmm. thought for a moment, and then he said, I say, don't be hating. You know, don't be hating on yourself. Don't be hating on others. But I'm wondering, do you just come right out and say compassion?
So compassion is very much like mindfulness was. I think it's becoming much more in currency these days, and especially because if you frame it in terms of this gradual build as to why compassion is important for leadership as well as in business, it really starts to make sense to people. So when we talk about compassion and we work with compassion in our curriculum, we really start with the foundation of mindfulness, building that awareness within oneself, and then we talk about how to extend it to others. And then that's the part where we can start to bring in the notion of empathy and compassion. Because one of the outcomes of our program, other than wellness, is effective leadership. And leadership here is being understood as a verb, as something that is enacted, as a skill that's being enacted. So when we really drill down on leadership, we start to talk to people about how leadership really entails building trust and psychological safety, because we know that those are core factors that contribute to effective leadership, and that in order to, and also influence. Once you have the trust and psychological safety, you can really start to work with teams and guide culture. And so taken from that perspective, empathy and compassion in particular are critical skills, because empathy allows for, of course, the perspective taking and understanding and then of others mm-hmm. And of the broader team and culture. And then compassion allows for that question around what would be of greatest service and benefit to others.
Mm-hmm.
So those qualities then engender the trust, the psychological safety, the influence that make for effective leadership. So when we frame it that way, then is when we can start to really engage in the conversation about compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And then importantly, it's not only a conceptual conversation, like these are the terms, here's the definitions, all sounds good, empathy is perspective and understanding, compassion is service and benefit. Well, how do you actually experience that? How do you cultivate that as a quality and a state of being as a leader? So then we have them engage in experiential practices that start to touch in to that skill set and help them really think about how they can bring it forward for their teams. And by the way, I appreciate that George says that you can't always talk directly about mm-hmm. compassion, but mm-hmm. I also want to say that I think it's starting to become much more in currency. So I live here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and our basketball team, the Golden State Warriors, just won their third championship in 4 years. They're officially a dynasty. They're one of the all-time great teams. And very publicly, they say our four team principles are joy, mindfulness, compassion, and competitiveness. So even especially high-performing teams, you see that they really value these qualities.
Steve Curry.
Yeah.
I know the name of like one player a decade or something. So he's my decade. Well, I think, you know, going back to George for a second, you know, I think one of Phil Jackson's great principles was think like a team, you know, and even when you have these like brilliant superstars who strive for individual excellence, that can't be all they're doing. They have to think like a team. And so that kind of brings up compassion and empathy automatically, even if you don't use those words, which is very interesting. But I feel like I need to check in with you maybe like once a year, say, how's it going now, you know?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I think we see each other roughly at least once a year for retreats and other things. So absolutely. And I think I just wanted to comment on that, Sharon, because I think the notion really is exactly as you say, which is how do you move beyond the self?
Mm-hmm.
How do you move beyond the self? And I think that cultivating empathy and compassion really starts to move one in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it's so effective for, you know, leaders and for teams in general.
And another thing I wanted to ask you about was resilience, because, you know, I do some amount of work with caregivers, whether it's in one's personal life or professional life, you know, people who are working on the front lines of a lot of suffering, humanitarian aid workers, domestic violence shelter workers, you know, teachers, nurses, all kinds of people. And so resilience is just this core issue, because, you know, I've also been interested to see kind of the movement for more empathy training, which I consider crucial and wonderful. But these people have a lot of empathy, you know, they're burning out for some other reason. And I haven't really thought much about resilience in the world of business, you know, and the pressures and the hours and the sense of performance and success or failure. And but it must be there, right?
It's critical. Yeah, having resilience in the face of daily, because the challenges are daily, is absolutely critical. And we know that, by the way, so that is something we measure in our and I could talk at some point about the kind of metrics that we're finding on all of these things, because they're really interesting. But one of the things we know from our curriculum is we do see people experience much greater resilience. So pre and post program, for example, we know that we see a 16% rise in people's resilience. They respond to this question about facing difficult situations and being able to focus on opportunities. So kind of turning the corner from being stuck on a challenge to seeing opportunities within it. We see a rise in that. We see a rise in people reporting that they can bounce back quickly after an emotionally challenging situation, right? Which, you know, probably are emotionally challenging situations are something that happen daily, many times a day in business settings, because people are working both at pace, with a huge scope, and then with other people who potentially have competing agendas. And so they're constantly challenged emotionally. And so being able to bounce back from that kind of emotional challenge is critical. And there we see almost, what do we see here? We see a 26-point increase in people, percentage point increase in people's ability to deal with emotionally challenging situations when they acquire the tools of mindfulness, empathy and compassion and emotional intelligence vis-a-vis our programs. So it's really, it really does move the needle on resilience.
That's fantastic. So let's talk about the metrics for a moment.
Yeah.
Do you study every program that you do?
Yeah. Yeah. We do, yeah. So we've been collecting data. You know, we have data from hundreds and hundreds of participants in over 15 countries because we've been running our program. The program was really started at Google 11 years ago, and about 6 years ago, we spun off the nonprofit institute, Silly, and you know have been collecting data ever since. And so we see some really meaningful double-digit shifts in terms of not only resilience, but things like leadership, the ability to deal with conflict, to pause before reacting, see double-digit shifts there, the ability to focus, prioritize what's important, a double-digit shift there, almost a 20 percentage point shift pre-post program, and noticing and being able to shift distracted states to more focused states, also there a 20% percentage point increase. And then stress, reduced levels of stress because people have these tools. And then really meaningfully for business people, Sharon, I think the ways that this could enhance operating profit or cost savings, basically, and enhance revenue. So we know that in some of our client systems, there are a roughly a 200% return on investment in some on this mindfulness programming that we offer. And specifically, that's because we see changes in wellness indexes that translate to greater profits. So let me be specific about that because there might be some people who are listening that really want to know exactly what is the case. Mm-hmm. So like in one of our major, major clients where we have literally thousands of employees being trained every year, that's SAP, which is a German software manufacturer. We see that there's about a 9.2% rise in well-being as a result of the SIOI program. And then SAP estimates that every 1 percentage point increase in business health culture index, which is their, you know, the health of their workforce, adds about 85 million to 95 million euros to their operating profit yearly.
Wow.
Yeah. So similarly, every 1 percentage point increase in employee engagement translates into a rise of about 50 million euros to 60 million euros yearly in operating profit. And we know that people who go through the SIOI curriculum at this particular organization, SAP, experience a 6.5% increase in employee engagement over a six-month period after they've experienced the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So we know that there's some real tie-in between the benefits that they experience and actual operating profit, actually cost savings, and then, you know, revenue increases for a company like SAP, but as well as many of the other companies we work with. So I think that to translate all that into English, I would just say it's good for employees and it seems like good business as well.
So tell me how it kind of works. So if I have a company and I engage Silly, then what happens? It's a certain amount of weeks or months, right? And then are there ongoing programs? Are there, is there like continuing education? Do you leave someone at the company, you know, to help troubleshoot or what goes on?
Yeah, so we really like to offer live experiences that in aggregate last for about 2 full days. Because in our experience, in order to instantiate and form the habit of mindfulness practice and compassion practice and emotional intelligence, it takes about what would amount to about 2 full days. So we offer kind of workshop related settings in which people can experience this, but we also do digital learning. So post workshop, post live experience, they also have digital learning. And what they do is essentially they get mindfulness practices over a course of about a month sent over 28 days to their inbox. And then after that, webinars. And so it's kind of a blended learning solution or blended learning approach that really combines live experiential sessions in cohorts together with digital learning for the sustainment of the skills. And that's how we find that over time, people are able to like really integrate mindfulness and emotional intelligence practices into their daily ways of working.
And then say somebody's done that. And the reason I'm asking, part of the reason I'm asking is because one of the other things I've known you very involved in is working with implicit bias within trainings.
Yeah.
And so is that sort of like once you've done the silly training, you might invest in a very particular kind of training, or is that all woven in?
No, we also offer much more specific experiences. So everything I just referred to previously is essentially our foundational mindfulness and emotional intelligence offering. And then we have much more focal offerings that draw on those skills to think about, you know, executive leadership and then organizational culture change, how to use these tools to really craft a culture that's mindful and compassionate and emotionally intelligent. We have a workshop and an offering on using the tools of mindfulness and compassion to address implicit bias. You know, as you've said, and then we even have a workshop called Joy on Demand, which is really about, you know, using mindfulness as a foundation to build the skills of sustainable and lasting happiness, broadly defined the way you define it, right? Which is to us a sense of thriving, resilience, and flourishing.
Someone could keep. Are you still creating programs?
And we're still creating. Yeah, I mean, we're just even installing the ones that we already have is taking a lot of our bandwidth. But you know, we are constantly upgrading the content and thinking about different permutations, different versions of the content. And so we're in a state of constant build and deploying the core programs. The other important thing to know is that we really have increasingly been working through a network of certified teachers of the curriculum. And so we train and certify mindfulness and emotional intelligence teachers with this specific approach, you know, the Google curriculum. And we train and certify them and have, at the end of next year, we're going to have over 700 certified teachers in over 40 countries around the world. So we really try to get this this curriculum out through our global network of teachers. And then people are welcome to also, of course, like make this their work. Similar to the journey that I charted for myself personally, we get a lot of people who say, oh, I want to become a trained and certified teacher. We have roughly about 75 on average people per training cohort, 75 teachers from, you know, different aspects of work and consulting and education who come to get certified, and then they bring that back into their arena of work. It's just been a really wonderful thing to see how much interest and how sort of sector diverse these tools are being applied by our teachers.
Do nonprofits come to you as well? Is that part of the...
Yeah. We work with nonprofits. We also work with, you know, cities, state, and federal agencies. Again, these tools are for human flourishing, both for wellness and sustaining high performance and effective leadership. And so pretty much any institution anywhere could use doses of that. And so we kind of make that happen. You know, absolutely. You know, it's very satisfying to be doing that work, in fact, for this very reason, right?
Yeah.
The tools we're offering are, you know, kind of along this dimension of greater mindfulness, greater empathy, compassion, and emotional intelligence. And like you said earlier, you know, who doesn't want that?
Right.
Who couldn't use that? It's only going to make us better. And so it's just such a, I'm so, so happy to be doing this work. And, you know, I said earlier, I left a corporate career to kind of follow this path. And what I didn't say was that, like, I'm so happy I did, you know,
I mean,
not that there's anything, again, wrong with having a corporate job. I did for 17 years and I grew tremendously. But where I'm at now is that I'm pretty much happier than I've ever been and feeling so blessed and grateful to be doing this work.
So great. Well, one of the things we talked about when we were just doing sound check, which, you know, has not been on the air thus far, is your thought about starting a deli in New York. So I'm sorry that didn't happen for the sake of New Yorkers. It would have been like the happiest deli in the world. You just go in, you cheer up, you have a little conversation. You're recognized as a human being with innate dignity, whoever you are. You know, there's compassion all around. And then you leave with your potato salad or whatever it is.
That's it, Sharon. Well, because we were joking, because I have a PhD, I've never really used it clinically. I've used it in industry, but really for me, it stands for PH Deli, and I wanted to start a deli in New York where I grew up, and to do exactly that, right? To have a happy place for people to convene.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I do want to keep checking in with you because I'm, of course, interested in the trajectory of compassion, the very word, and our ability to use it boldly. But really, this has been wonderful. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sharon. It's been a pleasure. And thank you all for your time and attention, those of you who are listening. Thank you.
And to learn more about Rich and his inspiring work, you can visit www.silly, that's SIYLI.org. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Sharon's many offerings and her ongoing teaching schedule, please visit her website at SharonSalzberg.com.